tonight on Arena. Artists Charles Tyrrell and Helen O'Leary on their exhibition Duet, and singer-songwriter Maria Kelly performs live in studio. Five one double 51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. But we start this evening with the National Concert Hall, who today announced its most ambitious season yet. 60 world-class concerts and events from September this year through until the end of May 2025. Season showcases dynamic musicians and ensembles. The Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra will be there with Sir Simon Rattle, the Philip Glass Ensemble in Residence, and the National Symphony Orchestra with international guest soloists and conductors. New artists in residence include American composer Bryce Dessner of The National and Irish opera star Tara Erocht and Jesse Grimes, who will present a series of family-friendly concerts. Delighted that Jesse is with me in studio this evening, along with conductor Gavin Maloney, to tell us more about this new season. Although I am very disappointed, Jesse Grimes, that you don't have your clarinet and that you weren't playing along with the theme tune.
That's true, that costs more, I'm afraid.
But will you? Yeah, well, of course you'll have your clarinet at the concerts that you're going to be involved in.
I would probably bring a clarinet for workshops that we're doing with the concert hall, but most of the things on the main stage are just me dancing around, presenting and narrating different shows. There's 7 main stage shows that I'm doing.
Are you going to be narrating Revolting Rhymes?
They're film screenings. Stickman and Revolting Rhymes are film screenings. So I'm doing Our Precious Planet and Peter and the Wolf, A Young Person's Guide. And then we're doing 2 symphony shorts, which is this awesome model where we take kind of the brilliant piece from the Friday night concert and make it a family-friendly, ASD-friendly, accessible concert where we just have a load of fun. And I break down what's amazing about this music. So we're doing Beethoven 5 and Berlioz Symphony Fantastique in a symphony shorts.
You're doing this. Kind of unmistakable opening, isn't
right?
it? Beethoven's 5th Symphony.
Yeah.
So you will take that, which will have been performed. Are you conducting that, by the way, incidentally, Gavin Maloney? Do you happen to be conducting that one on the Friday night before Jesse talks about it?
I don't happen to be conducting that one, but I'm greatly looking forward to conducting 2 of the family concerts that Jesse's doing, and they are Our Precious Planet and Peter and the Wolf.
Right, mm-hmm. We'll come back to Our Precious Planet and Peter and the Wolf. But you take something like Beethoven's 5th Symphony there, and you talked about these concerts being ASD friendly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Beethoven's 5th Symphony isn't exactly the quietest piece of music in the world. So how do you approach, and this is about making it a suitable experience for people on the autistic spectrum disorder.
Well, it's for everybody, but we want to make the space inclusive for everybody. So those with neurodivergence, it's not just, it can sometimes be a stereotype that loud music is stressful, but for some people it might be. So it's a relaxed performance. People are free to come and go as they want. We'll make a quiet breakout space for people to go and chill out if they need to kind of take some space and time. And it's generally more about making it feel comfortable. People don't have to sit in their seat and do things. If they feel like they need to move, they can move. They feel like they want to make a noise, they can make a noise. And I'll incorporate it and we'll work all together to kind of create a really fun, interactive experience.
So it becomes the event is what's happening on that day. It doesn't have, you're not... behaviour in the concert hall. Behave yourself. That's
no nonsense. I'm opposite of behaviour. I want chaos. That's where I thrive the most. So, you know, I'll write a script and we'll make a whole show out of it and we'll take apart all of the amazing elements of that Beethoven uses. So, I don't know what, I actually haven't written it yet.
Yeah.
We'll be using all of those musical elements in basically all of the symphony shorts. I'll turn some of the melodic ideas into a song. We'll perform together. I'll have some movement. We'll play some games and there'll be big chunks of the music. So it's not just kind of messing around. It'll be really an immersive Beethoven experience.
So and obviously it's going to be the same thing when it comes to the performance with Gavin. You may think you know the young person's guide to the orchestra. This may be a totally new version, Gavin.
It may indeed. I look forward to it very much. It's a wonderful piece of music, and it's a great pairing with Peter and the Wolf, really two of the greatest children's pieces for orchestra ever written.
Yeah. And you are narrating Peter and the Wolf.
I'm narrating it, and we have a really cool shadow puppeteer who's working with us for that. So the two ones that Gavin and I are doing together, Our Precious Planet, is being live illustrated by Grégoire Pont. And that's his illustrations are so beautiful. So this is an amazing sort of visual and audio piece of art, an immersive experience. So that's a narrated kind of a script vibe. And then Peter and the Wolf, of course, and Young Person's Guide is another narration. And we have some beautiful visuals. And then the Symphony Shorts is a bit more free and fun and spontaneous.
I guess, Gavin, when I listen to Jessie talk the way she is speaking about music there, without now sounding as if you're not in the room with us, but you are in the room. You can hear clearly the passion that she has for the music. And I know you have that same passion for the music, but to be able to communicate that passion in the way Jessie will to a young audience, that's hugely exciting in terms of these symphony shorts, isn't it?
I knew Jessie first a long time ago, exclusively as a clarinetist, a very fine clarinetist. And it's amazing to see her branch out into this very powerful communication about music.
So what, did you know Jessie as a student? Or
We did. We knew each other.
Yeah, I had to behave myself.
you were her teacher? Were you teaching her in some situation?
We're talking like 20 years
ago. Very long time ago.
Yeah, but that's okay. Yeah. It doesn't matter that it's 20 years ago. So you were the boss, were you?
In a manner of speaking, we came across each other, yeah.
But seeing this, it is one of the challenges of classical music. You know, those of us who know it and love it. But some people kind of feel, oh, that's not for me. And, oh, do I really have to go to that? Do I have to eat my broccoli? You know, do I have to do the vegetables? So how do you communicate the passion that you so clearly feel?
I find myself almost getting a bit cross comparing it to broccoli.
Fair enough.
Because I think it's all just music. And
broccoli's lovely, by the way.
Big fan. I feel really, really, really strongly about this, that it's all music. It is all equal. It is all sacred. It is all important. It is all powerful, whether it's the Pussycat Dolls or Beethoven. It's all got a really important and powerful place, particularly in young people's lives. And I think one of the starts or the end points is that, like, young people are exposed to this sort of music, orchestral music, as I like to say. I don't say classical.
Yeah.
But they're exposed to it all the time. It's in video games. It's on TV. It's in movies. It's everywhere. And it's about just pointing out that this is a huge, amazing part of your life already. And you're welcome and invited here to this space to explore this music as much as. And we can take away the barriers of the feelings of it having to be very formal or whatever, that you can go and sing along in the same way that you would at a pop concert. As far as I'm concerned, that's what I want, that sort of open chaos, because I think that's where the music can be alive and continue to thrive and live. And some the NCH were talking about, and it's a really nice sentence. We're talking about future-proofing reach and relevance. And it's a fancy sentence. That's not
good
the sort of
sentence.
Thing I would say. But it is that, like, if we can make this music and the concert hall and everything that we do there as open and as accessible for everyone, that does future-proof things, because the more people involved and interested, the more alive and more dynamic the space and the music that we make can be.
We're talking about future-proofing. Our Precious Planet sounds as if that's all about making sure we have a precious planet, and it is about future-proofing. What exactly is involved in that particular concert?
It's a really exciting programme, including music by Messiaen, Sarajevo, Anna Meredith, Britten, Ginastera, Poulenc. So it's really extraordinary to be able to make this music accessible and to present it in such an imaginative way, both with the visuals and with Jessie's presentation.
Yeah, tell me a little bit more about those visuals. I mean, because I guess you've conducted film scores before, so this idea of matching and syncing music with visuals isn't, you know, you're not reinventing the wheel. But this sounds as if it is a kind of a new take on that.
I think so, and I'm looking forward to seeing in the rehearsals exactly how it works. But this illustrator and animator, Grégoire Pont, is going to live illustrate. So he'll be drawing as the music plays. Yeah. So it's a really, really imaginative way of approaching a fabulous programme.
And some of the music here, some of it is challenging music, for sure, Jessie. I mean, I was talking to you beforehand. Somebody sent me today a clip of you playing Messiaen, the quartet for the end of time, the wonderful clarinet part that's in that. Some the Messy End that's here and the other some of the other pieces here, they're not necessarily the straightforward listen.
Do you know what? I think that's a grown-up's point of view. Because we've learned all these things, we've made all these assumptions, but young people and people who don't enter the world of orchestral music, they're blank canvas. So you can play Anna Meredith and you can play Mozart and they're going to listen to it equally and be like, yeah, that's cool. Well, I like that bit. So I think all of it is totally accessible as far as I'm concerned because it's all just amazing.
So that categorization is something that I, as an adult, I'm constantly doing. But a child's mind, of course, as a sponge, is much more open to any musical experience than that.
Yeah, and it's not just kids as well. It's just people who haven't lived in that world or are not super familiar with it. I think it's a really exciting audience to work with because everything is on the table. You can present anything and not feel like in the sort of more formal traditional concert hall way of like, oh, we must play Mozart to balance out the squeaky gate contemporary music that we're going to play. And I think it's really also I think the whole program, the whole season is doing that in an amazing way, that there's so much. Like that, Our Precious Planet concert feels like a kind of a microcosm of what the whole season is about. It's balancing the traditional stuff with the more interesting, newer takes.
I have to say, because oftentimes I listen to the sort of music that my sons are listening to on gaming platform that goes along with games. And some of it, in inverted commas, is very challenging and very if you think of it in those terms, because it can have that dissonance. It can have all of those, counterintuitive things, not a big lush lyrical melody necessarily, and yet they listen to that because they like the sound of it.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, one of the concerts I'm looking forward to is on New Year's Day because there are a number of anniversaries reflected in this season, but this one is of particular interest to me. It's Johann Strauss II, and just on the point you make about various kinds of music, it was Brahms who paid homage to Johann Strauss II's ability to write melodies. And so we have in this concert the amazing Jennifer Davis, who's been singing with English National Opera recently. And because it's 200th birthday of Johann Strauss, we have favourites such as Die Fledermaus Overture and, of course, the Blue Danube.
And I think you're also going to have this. Now, I wanted to get to that little bit with the whippy sound at the back of it there in the Tritch Tratch Polka, because I was saying as we were listening to that, at the time that Strauss was writing that, that was kind of going against all the laced up conventions of Vienna and kind of throwing in the whip and having a bit of crack with it. Well, no pun intended, having a bit of fun with it. So, and Jesse quite rightly said, all music was new once upon a time. I suppose we can underestimate the immediacy of music like that.
I think it's partly to do with the times we live in, that there's so much categorization and kind of putting things in boxes. And certainly Vienna at the time that music was written wouldn't have been quite the same way. And they would have been the same musicians playing Mozart, Schubert and the Schnell Polka, certainly.
Yeah, and they wouldn't have been worrying about which particular category they were finding themselves in. And then we got to I was asking which of you was involved in the Symphonie Fantastique. You're going to tell the story there, Jesse, are you? On the day. Is this one of the Symphonie Shorts as well?
That's the Symphonie Shorts one. So we've got kind of an hour to explode Symphonie Fantastique and make it as colourful. It already is Technicolor anyway, but to take out all of the awesome elements. I'm really, really looking forward to that one because I think it's going to paint, I'm going to be able to paint an amazing story and we're going to have so many amazing sounds to play with and explore.
It tells such a wonderful story, the idea of this kind of artist guy who's so madly in love that he's prepared to do anything for his beloved and kind of echoes of Berlioz and the Irish actress Harriet Smithson. They say he wrote this piece for her. It's mm-hmm. a big love story here.
Yeah, yeah. It's a really strong story, which, you know, for young people, love stories are kind of boring. So we'll all be focusing in on the old witches as well.
I was going to say, yeah, they'd probably like the bit where he's marching up to the gallows and, well, yeah, yeah. and everything is going terribly wrong.
Make it not too scary.
All right, yeah. Are there other elements within the overall season that you'd like to highlight?
Well, on the theme of all music being new ones, there is a great deal of very interesting new music. For example, I'm involved in a project called Composer Lab, the main performance of which is taking place on the 21st of January. And that takes four already established composers and they go through a mentoring process with Dave Fennessy and myself and produce four works for the National Symphony Orchestra. So that's a strand in this ambitious yeah. season that is, I believe, the first to bring together all the NSO and NCH programming in one idea and in one booklet.
I'm wondering, Jesse, you know, given, you know, the clear communicative abilities you have, was there somebody in your early musical upbringing or your early musical life who kind of opened music up to you in the way you want to do in this series that you're involved in?
I think to say one is kind of tricky because there's so many like pivotal moments of amazing educators or teachers in my life. Probably the great Dr. Albert Bradshaw, who taught at Mount Temple Comprehensive School. I don't know if you ever came across him. He lectures at Trinity, or certainly did, in Solfège. And he had us singing Mozart arias or four part pieces in Solfège in like second year. And so he was really ambitious. You could choose to do non-curriculum music with Albert because he refused to do the curriculum.
Well, I think even the term non-curriculum music is, you immediately want to do that.
Yeah, yeah. He was awesome. And I think he played the Adagietto from Mahler 5 when we were all particularly stressed out teenagers having just done our mocks or something for the junior cert. And he had us to kind of tae a culla on the table and just listen to this. And it totally changed everything. I remember going up to him afterwards and being like, how do you spell that? Like M-A-H. And I used to put that on mixtapes to impress all the girls that I fancied for years afterwards, because I thought it was the most amazing thing. But there's so many different amazing people. Like the National Youth Orchestra, I think I auditioned about six times and finally got in. And you said very nice things about me as a young player, but like it took me a while to get there. That experience of sitting and playing in an orchestra was something that really changed again something in my brain of like, oh, this is really amazing. So I feel quite strongly that I want to give that opportunity to as many people as possible to have that feeling of what it's like to be surrounded by this ocean of sound.
I wonder whether particularly you mentioned the Mahler and the Adagietto, which is the Death in Venice music is how most people would recognise it. Of course, as a woodwind player, you'd be sitting there doing nothing in that particular slow movement other than letting the string music waft over, drench you, I presume. Yeah. Must be a wonderful feeling.
Yeah, I have actually cried in concerts before. And often, sort of as professional musicians, it's quite like, we're going to get on with our job. And I'd have to sit there quietly, gently weeping to that, because it's just so powerful.
Yeah, ever cried in the middle of a concert, Gavin?
Maybe
for all the wrong reasons, as you.
Better not to when you're conducting. Better. No, I think it's a funny thing about conducting is that you're the only person who doesn't make any sound, or at least doesn't make any voluntary sounds.
Well, listen, it does sound, I mean, you've given us, I think, a sense of the fun that you both want to knock out of this upcoming season. Yes, go on, Jesse.
I want to say one more thing, which I think I was live watching my parents go through this season. They're like subscribers to the NSO for years. And this is the first time that the NSO and the NCH have been combined together.
Of course, yes.
And one of the big notable things is the accessibility for every concert. The tickets start at €15, which is huge. Like my dad was like, oh, I've never done the international series, it's a bit too expensive. But now every concert starts at a much cheaper rate, and I think that accessibility is at the core of the season, and I'm super proud to be connected with that because I think it's really important.
Well, a point well made, and thanks to both of you for coming into us this evening. That's Gavin Maloney and Jesse Grimes, and you can find out full details of the upcoming season on nch.ie. An exhibition at the Claire Mollis Gallery in County Mayo brings the work of two very distinctive artists together. Abstract painter Charles Tyrrell and unconventional history painter, as she refers to herself. History painter is that. That is, not sure about the unconventional bit. You can tell me yourself. Helen O'Leary are the people involved in the exhibition. Delighted to say that both Helen and Charles are with me in studio this evening following the opening of their exhibition at the weekend. Congratulations to both of you on the exhibition, first of all, and Charles, to you as well, on being a prize winner at the RHA annual exhibition in Dublin, the Graphic Studio Dublin Wilkinson Award for your work Stony Road Pink, one of a number of works in the exhibition. I guess no matter how long you've been doing it and how accomplished you are, it's always nice to get the prize, I would guess.
Absolutely, yeah, I didn't say no. Yeah, it was good. It was lovely.
What do those prizes, even at, you know, because you're a well-established artist at this point, what do those prizes mean to you, just when they do come up?
I think we artists aren't good at giving themselves a clap on the back. We're always galloping forward to the next thing. So I think it's nice when somebody comes in from the side and gives you a clap on the back and gives you a prize, and it's hugely appreciated. Yeah.
And in terms of this exhibition, which is called Duet, obviously, Helen, mm-hmm. because the two of you are involved in it, how related would you have seen your work before this exhibition idea came up?
Well, I've admired Charles' work forever now. And we both come from painting. We both are abstract painters. And I would have seen a line between us, you know, just there's a sense of precision in both of our works. And we come to it from a very different spot.
Places.
But yeah, the precision is what brings us together.
And did you see that connection too, Charles?
I saw also, I'm also a huge fan, reciprocally a huge fan of Helen's. And it's interesting that the question interests me in a way because I've been thinking about it a lot. And in many ways, I nearly prefer not to have an answer in some odd way because I'm loving the connection that I know is there, but maybe don't like the idea of hammering it home too much or, you know, tying it down. It sort of floats between us. There's something particular that floats between us, you know.
That only happens in, I suppose, when the works go together. And I'll talk a little bit further about that in a while. But I want to tweet a couple of images as we go along here. One from each of you, in fact, at RTE Arena, if you want to see these images as we speak about them. And the first is yours, Charles. It has the title CG 3.22 island canvas.
Highly poetic titles, you might notice.
Yes, yeah, very lyrical title. Maybe you describe the work to us first of all, if you would, Charles.
Okay, well, what you'd be looking at is a kind of a wonky distorted grid, and they come. The grid has always been somewhere involved in my work, but usually as a sort of an underpinning. It's there that, you know, all abstract artists come from some sort of structured area of grid. And I just decided that I'd focus on it as a subject and work my way into it. And I ended up developing images by a series of random placing of squares and rectangular shapes on the field, be it the page, the canvas, or whatever. And then they're all just randomly independent of each other. And then I pull them together into an organized grid. And for me, that is a sort of finding the sort of the shape of the awkward shape, often the slightly distorted shape of making a unit out of disparate units.
Disparate pieces. Yeah. Because, for example, in the work that we're looking at now, you know, a grid in most terms is straight lines down, straight lines across. Absolutely So what we have on this piece that I'm looking at in front of me on the screen and that people can see on at RTE Arena, there are times when the squares are slightly off kilter.
Totally.
So those squares existed totally separately and you pull them in together then.
So I pull them together. Yeah. So there's all this distortion, you know, and there's an accommodation all the time, pushing and pulling and creating, you know, it locks together finally. It locks together maybe awkwardly, maybe not all that pretty, you know, but I think there is some sort of a beauty in the accommodation that is necessary to make this unit, a kind of a solid unit. And you could apply that thinking to any sort of societal organisation,
well, funny enough,
political organisation.
Yeah, yeah, politics. But even as you were, you're mentioning it there, and we just come out of the piece about music, this mm-hmm. is, you are composing the image here. You're literally taking little parts and putting them together.
That's correct. Yeah, but there's a certain detachment in the whole thing, insofar as I don't know how that final image is going to really finally manifest itself.
Yeah, when you see it, you know what's right, but you don't know what's there. Precisely. What's right until you see it.
Precisely. Yeah, and I enjoy that aspect of making images. Mm. A certain detachment. It has an autonomy. The work has an autonomy of its own. That's important.
I think that grid aspect is one of the factors in Charles's work that particularly attractive to you, Helen.
Absolutely. I work with a different kind of a grid. Mine is more fractured and splintered. And I dismantle and then I rebuild.
Well,
let's
tweet an image of one of your works here, again, at RTE Arena, to look at this. And it's simply referred to here as artwork too. It has the look of a harp in some ways of it. I don't know if you know the piece I'm speaking about. I can't turn it around for you to see it. It's like a collage piece. Is it made of wood?
Yes, I think the title was Sore Spot on that one. But
describe Sore Spot to it and to me.
It's an accumulation of bits. I work from my own history. That's where the history painting comes in. And I work from my own edits, and I knit with wood, and I build up these forms that find their own shape. They find their own shape through a process of restoration.
So these pieces of wood, have you found them? These are literally found bits, or have you cut them into different shapes and
thrown
them?
They're my own edits. They're my own kind of failures. And I continually kind of pull from my own waste, I suppose.
So in other words, the bits that you have done a little bit of work on and said, that's not working, and you throw it to the one side, suddenly there's 50 or 60 of them sitting over in the corner, and you start to combine them into something that satisfies you.
My studio is like an archaeological site. It's just... it looks like a bit of a war zone, and there's bits that I just pull out of it. And then I work with other people's bits as well. Gary Leahy, he makes lovely bows in Westport, and he keeps all these little bits for me. And I love them because they bleed. It's Pernambuco. And no matter what you do to it, if you put the gesso, I use ground eggshells to make the white that you're looking at there. And it bleeds through it, and it's beautiful.
And when do you explain, he's a bow maker.
He's a bow maker, yeah.
Like violin bows, instrumental bows, yes.
Yeah.
And what piece of the waste do you? What piece of the?
The shreds of wood, like bits of wood, like bits that aren't good enough to be a bow, and they're so beautiful. God, it's beautiful.
Yeah,
I make a die out of it, and it's lovely.
So the bits that are kind of thrown away are the bits that attract you in that respect. When I heard the name Tyrrelland, it suddenly struck me, Charles. Mm. Yeah, of course, Tyrrellstown, County Meath. You are originally from County Meath, but not from Tyrrellstown.
No, I've come from the town of Trim, born and bred there, and love the town. But I now live on the Bear Peninsula, in West Cork, up the side of a mountain.
Well, you can't get much different than inland, totally landlocked Meath,
yes,
and the Burra Peninsula,
yes,
on the wilds of the Atlantic Ocean.
I know.
How do you think that informs your work? I mean, can you look at work that you made as a younger person, perhaps in Meath, and say, oh yeah, that's Meath, and this is Burra?
I would say I haven't really made adult work in Meath, so it's been Dublin or West Cork. But it's an interesting question as to how the landscape and the environment informs the work. And it's not a direct, it doesn't have a direct road into my work, but it certainly has a place in it. I live with certain, natural beauties, colours, power, the power of geology that's all around me. So all that in a way feeds indirectly in. But I'm not a responder. I don't respond to my environment. I'm not looking at the landscape looking to how can I work with that. I don't abstract from anything. Yeah. I go at it from a different direction. So I often find the landscape comes in, but I kind of regard it as a guest who has decided that he'd like to come in rather than me going to chasing
always
after.
Always a welcome guest, or sometimes get out of my house.
Exactly. Sometimes I think, oh, no, that's too much. I don't want that reference, or that's too.
Yeah, because it does strike me when I look at the grid painting that we were looking at earlier on. It has the feeling of a more urban space, possibly because we think of the grids and the blocks, particularly on the island of Manhattan and different American cities and towns. Yeah. Do you have any sense of that urban quality within the grid paintings in particular?
Yes, I do, I think. And through my work, I've been sort of adamant with my engagement with abstraction, and kind of abstraction really comes from an urban, standpoint in some way. You know, it's very much constructed, and all the thinking seems to be in that direction. So, it is always there. I often joke about going to the studio that I put on blinkers to avoid the the temptations.
Seeing the beauty of the landscape
around you.
You have a duality of, well, I think the trim bit might be to the one side when it comes to the art, because it was just early in Charles's life. But there's a quite definite current moment duality to your work. You teach it one semester a year in the US, and then this is at Penn State University, and then you're in the science department there, and then you're back in... Go ahead.
No, I'm in the art department, with the soil science and plant science department.
Yeah, so talk to me about that kind of interaction. There's this constant idea that the arts and the sciences, they're two very different things, but not as you're describing.
They're very close together. You know, I'm interested in place very much. So the work that I'm working on now is to do with the notion of home, the notion of what's there and what's in the soil, what's under the soil, what's sustainable. I work with dyes, pigments. So to work at a Research One university, I've all that, I've geographers, I've soil scientists, I've plant scientists, and we all work together. We invented a solar dye cart, so we can go off into the landscape and get colours out of it.
And so you have that aspect to your work, but then the other part of the year is spent living in Drumshambo, County Leitrim. Do you see, now Charles is saying that he doesn't feel, he has to put the blinkers on to avoid the landscape seeping in. Are you more reactive to your environment in that respect?
I think I am. I mean, my work is fracture, and I have a very fractured life. I have a studio in Jersey City. I teach at the university, and I too live up a mountain in Drumshambo. I think I just leech from all of those landscapes and all of those, the bustle of New York. I'm 40 minutes to the Met, which I bought the house because it was 40 minutes to the Met.
The Metropolitan Opera House.
And then I live in the science labs at the university. And then when I'm up that mountain, I say, I'll never come down. I'm going to throw away my passport and I'll never come down. And all of those feed my work, it all does.
And you went to art college in the 70s, Charles. You're contemporaries of people like Martin Gale. How exciting a time was that in terms of how art was beginning to change and manifest itself?
Well, it was exciting. We were right in the middle of change and demanded change and sought change, which eventually came. But we were in the middle of...
What kinds of changes were you looking for at that time?
Well, a much broader education than what was sort of basically a kind of a 19th century academic
classical painting, and that's it.
Yeah, and that's it. You know, which was fine and very important, but it was very narrow. And at this stage, the education system, say in Britain, had developed into a much broader experience. And I'd say that was really the sort of model that we would have been aiming at. So slowly but surely it did happen, but not in our time. So we kind of missed that. We sort of fell between the two stools. But in some odd way, it was exciting in being in that slight vacuum, slight no man's land. And there was huge, there was huge camaraderie and fellowship, I suppose.
I just, in a final question, to go back to the idea of how your two works sit together. When you see your work, Helen, sitting in the gallery as part of this in Claremorris, as part of this duet exhibition with Charles's work, How different does your work become to you when placed next to Charles's?
There's a stillness that happens between them, which is really interesting. Mm. And there's a minimalism that we're both embraced with, a response to minimalism. There's a difference, but they sit very well together.
And do you feel something similar?
Charles? Something similar, yeah. There's a word that I've come to, or an idea, a notion that I've come to realise that I think art should have and that I want my art to have, and that is desire. And I think that desire that both of us have somehow or other sings together, I think. Well, similar desire.
Yeah, and I suppose you only see what they do together when you put them together.
Yes, right. Yes.
A bit like you both described your separate practices. Thank you so much for coming in and speaking to me this evening. Duet is the title of the gallery, of the title of the exhibition, rather. It's at the Claire Morris Gallery. It runs through until June the 8th. Charles Turrell and Helen O'Leary, the two artists involved. Thanks both for coming into us this evening. Full details on ClaireMorrisGallery.ie. Singer-songwriter Maria Kelly released her debut album, The Sum of In Between, in 2021. And one of the tracks from that album, Someone Else, featured on the hit series Conversations with Friends. Now Maria is back with a brand new single, Drive, produced by her creative collaborator Matt Harris from Vita and Hawk. Drive has featured on the international trailer for Robert De Niro and Bobby Cannavale's feature film, Ezra. I'm delighted that Maria is with me in studio this evening. We were talking just about this during the break there, Maria. I was wondering, you know, obviously Someone Else being used in Conversations with Friends, and now the song Drive being used in the trailer at any rate. Do you know if it's in the film, Ezra?
It's not in the film, no. It's just in the trailer, yeah.
But is there something, do you think, in both of those pieces that has some kind of visual aspect to it, or that makes them suitable for cinematic and televisual material?
I don't know. The only thing I can guess is I think I'm very story-based with my writing. I love telling a story, and I think it was a massive amount of luck in terms of the person who was making the visual story matched up with what I had written about. I think with Sync it often works like that, where I was very lucky to be able to be in a position where my song was in that room with other songs being picked from, and they went with
and
mine.
Do you know that your song is in the room being considered in a situation like that? For example, did you know, oh yeah, Robert De Niro, Bobby Cannavale, etc. They're all looking at your song to think, will they use it in the trailer? Or the director of the film, obviously.
Well, now I'm imagining a table of actors deciding this.
Will we use that one? But were you aware that it was up for consideration?
And normally it works with... I like total transparency. I knew someone in that company who was pitching for songs, and they put forward my song. So, and it was said to me, we have no idea what they will go for, but we really like these. So they had put a few of my songs forward. We really like these few songs. We'll put them on the table to be picked from. And then I was picked, which was amazing.
Well, I watched a bit of the trailer today of Ezra and the song. Maybe you tell us what the song Drive is about, or why you wrote the song, and then we can see how it links into the story that's been told in the trailer of Ezra at any rate.
Yes. Well, for me, I wrote that song when I was kind of thinking back through relationships and friendships that maybe ended without having that kind of final conversation to explain why. I've always found it very difficult to move through like changing and growing apart from people. I know it's very, very normal, especially when you're younger, getting older, but I just have always found it quite difficult. So I think it's just thinking of someone and also being the type of person who would like drop everything and want to go and just fix the...
So if you had a car, you would drive and say, listen, let's have a chat.
Yeah, and then kind of a conclusion at the end of the song of trying to accept that that might not happen in the way you're daydreaming in your head that it will.
Well, I'll let you go to the microphone to sing, and I suppose that the story that is told in Drive is about a neurodivergent boy, and we see the song in the trailer as the neurodivergent boy and his father get into the car and drive off. So it makes sense. You can think of that as a kind of a picture to the background of this live performance of the new single from Maria Kelly. The song is called Drive.
Thank you. If I were to die tomorrow, I think I'd try to borrow my parents' car, and I'd drive where you are, and I'd tell you I'm sorry, and you'd say, fine, we'll try. Hoping you'd call, you have been on my mind. It's fine, just try. It's fine, just try. And I would do it for you if you ask me. If I were to die tomorrow, all of my pride I'd swallow, and I'd drive through the night and put up a fight and tell you I'm sorry, and you'd say, hey, I swear it's okay. I'd forgotten about all of that. And I would do it for you if you wish me to. I'd do it for you. I would do it for you if you wish me to. I'd do it for. I'm not gonna die tomorrow. I'm not gonna die tomorrow. And I don't try. And I'm still alive. I don't know where you live, but you live in a different. Once ours, now mine. It's fine, just try.
And that is the song Drive, performed live for us by Maria Kelly. And I have to say, Maria, quite an emotionally strong song that. I'll get you to come back over to the seat here to chat with me a little bit, because I'm wondering to what extent, if we think of Someone Else, which was the song that was used in Conversation with Friends, how, when a song is picked up like that and when it makes its way into a television programme like Conversation with Friends, or indeed into the trailer for the movie Ezra, what kind of effect does that have on the dissemination of the song?
Well, I think it reaches way more people than I thought it would. It's been great to see the reaction online. I think. Do you mean like the meaning of the song?
No. It's more just the simple exposure of it. Does it send people back? Can you get then sense even on Spotify that sends people back to your other material?
I think so. I think it's definitely piqued people's interest, and I think with this film, it's interesting because it's going to start coming out in like loads of different territories at different times over the next kind of
So you could 4 months. You can so, really measure the effect.
Yeah, so I'm interested to see when it starts coming out in more places, if people hear it in the trailer, they go, oh, what's that? And they want to go see. So it's never happened to me that that's happened before a song has come out. It was in the trailer and then the song was released a couple of weeks later. So it'll be really interesting to see.
See the effect of that. And is Drive then, it's a single, obviously the current single, mm-hmm. is it part of a bigger project? Is it heading towards an album or an EP?
It is part of a bigger project. It's part of one of those things, but I haven't technically saying it officially yet. But I've decided to just do a really slow burn with my next few songs. I've really wanted to release music in a way that felt just steady and good for my own head. So this is kind of the first.
I won't rush your slow burn then. I'll let you do it as a slow burn. You're going to finish up with the performance of a song from the first album again. This is One Bed, isn't it? Mm-hmm. You said you like to perform this one when you're out.
Yeah, this is probably one of my favourite songs. It's just for me, I'm a very sensitive person. I wrote this song about kind of moving through the world with high sensitivity and for anyone who wishes they could maybe turn that dial down and just have a day to themselves.
There you go. We'll let you go over to the microphone. And in the meantime, I'll tell you that Maria Kelly with Ezra Williams will be performing at the Roisin Dubh in Galway as part of the Galway Arts Festival. That's on Wednesday, July the 17th. And we'll be there ourselves in Galway for two shows on that very same week. We'll tell you more about that a little bit closer to the time. But here is Maria Kelly with One Bed. One Sunbed, the title of that track from Maria Kelly. And as I said, Maria and Ezra Williams will be in Rushing Dove in Galway as part of the Galway International Arts Festival Wednesday, July the 17th for that particular event. But that is our lot for this Monday evening here on Arena. Leah Murphy and Barbara Rose Sanmo were the researchers. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Aisling Grufferty was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. I will be back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RTE Radio 1. Look forward to that enormously. And remember, if you want to listen back to anything, you can always go to the website rte.ie/arena. John Creedon will be with you coming up after the 8 o'clock news.